Case number 19-4225, Louisville G&E Company et al. Versus FERC. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Blickensterfer, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Matt Blickensterfer on behalf of petitioners Louisville Gas and Electric Company and Kentucky Utilities Company. Your honors, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your honors, this case turns on the interpretation of a negotiated agreement accepted by FERC. That's an issue on which this court gives no deference to FERC. The interpretation begins, and in this case, ends with the language of the agreement, Rate Schedule 402. Under the plain language of Rate Schedule 402, depancaking credits require a purchase and delivery of electricity, and they are limited to the amount that the purchaser, quote, incurs to deliver such purchased energy, unquote. Incurs to deliver, your honors, means caused by the delivery of purchased energy. That is, the amount of depancaking credits is the amount that the delivery caused OMU to pay. Put another way, the credits are tied to the actual usage of the reservation, not the existence of the reservation itself. This language is reinforced by the definition of MMD transaction, which is the only type of transaction to which depancaking credits apply. Under the agreement, an MMD transaction is one that sources in MISO and sinks in LG&E's control area, or vice versa. Only a delivery of electricity can source or sink, your honors. A transmission reservation by itself does not source or sink. So by definition, an MMD transaction cannot be an unused transmission reservation. It must involve the delivery of electricity.
Counsel, can you help us? Your argument makes a certain amount of sense, especially, let's say, in a month where no delivery occurs at all. But how, when there is some delivery, do you want to prorate it for the moments when there's delivery, or do you want to say if you use it one day, you get to charge all day, or if you want to use it all week? That's my problem in trying to say that it's not ambiguous. Can you give me a what you would read it if we had that situation? How much credit do you want to give them? Do you want to give them any reservation credit for those days that they used it?
Yeah, absolutely, Judge Boggs. It's a great question. And the answer from our perspective is that it needs to be prorated. And that if FERC, that's a different case. If we got here and FERC had prorated and we didn't like the method that they had used to prorate, but that's a situation where I think FERC could prorate the usage and apply that in terms of creating the credits that they're
prorate it for the month. But
doesn't that sort of lean toward ambiguity? I mean, again, I used to work at the old Federal Power Commission 40 years ago, and looking at this contract, if I had been the lawyer on either side, and if I knew any economics at all, fixed costs versus variable costs, might I not have said, gee, I ought to write this contract a little differently, or at least recognize that there's a potential problem here?
Well, Your Honor, I would distinguish between what is clear in RS 402, which is that the credits are supposed to be tied to the delivery of purchased electricity. That much is clear. And the FERC result here violates that aspect of the tariff.
Now, yeah. Well, what about, please finish your answer, and then I'd like to ask you about some of the remainder of the contract.
Yeah, absolutely, Judge Strands. Just to finish the question from Judge Boggs, you know, the fact that FERC might have some wiggle room if we were here and they had done it differently, or if you sent it back and we are here again, the fact that they have some wiggle room perhaps on how they prorate it doesn't change the fact that the agreement has a clear mandate that the amount of depancaking credits must be that which was incurred to deliver purchased electricity. And what FERC did is completely unmoored from the delivery of purchased electricity.
Well, as point blank as that language is, what about the other language that's referenced, that the 402 says that the provisions that LG&E is to shield MMD partners from any pancaking of transmission charges, any pancaking, which is what is the issue here, that pancaking has occurred. And the provision that nothing in the tariff can be construed as limiting KU's municipal's right to enjoy the same service and pricing that they would have been entitled to receive absent the withdrawal from MISO. Don't both of those statements, in contrast to the incurred to deliver statement upon which you rely, show a recognition of ambiguity in the contract?
Don't think so, Judge Branch, and there's two reasons why, that I'll take each of them in turn. First, the provision that you quoted is from the definition of FERC, that you quoted first is from the definition of merger mitigation. And it says—
Can you speak up just a little bit, please?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
The first provision that you quoted is part of the definition of merger mitigation de-pancake in RS-402. And it says, shall mean the commitment of yield requirements from any repositioning of rates. But then in the same sentence, at the end, it says, as provided for in Section 1. Know what that means. Section 1, it says that the amount of—
Can we pause for just a minute? Is the panel able to hear?
No, we're losing his voice.
Judge Stranch, it might be his internet connection.
Yes, it may be. Mr. Dowling, is there anything we can do to—
I'm on a wired connection, Your Honors. I would hope that I wouldn't be having any problems, but—
And I'm noticing that there's a little bit of street noise coming in from Louisville. So maybe, Judge Boggs, I hate to ask you to do this. Maybe if we muted for just a little bit. Okay, thank you.
Is this any better, Your Honors?
That's better now.
Okay. I'll start with that answer again, Judge Stranch.
Please.
So, and I want to break it down into two pieces because you quoted two different pieces of the agreement. First, the first piece that you quoted comes from the definition of merger mitigation de-pancaking, which includes the language shall mean the commitment of applicants to shield from any re-pancaking of rates. At the end of that same sentence, though, as part of that same sentence, it says as provided for in Section 1 of this amended agreement. So by definition, within this definition, it's not any repancaking of rates, it's any pancaking of rates as provided for in Section 1. And Section 1 in turn tells us that the amount is what was charged for the delivery of purchased electricity. Now the second piece of the agreement that you quoted is in Section 4. And it says nothing herein shall be construed as limiting the KU municipal's rights to, quote, enjoy the same service and pricing that they would have been entitled to receive absent applicants' withdrawal as established in Louisville Gas and Electric with a FERC citation, and as established under Section 15.8 and Attachment E of applicants OATT. Applicants OATT is open access transmission tariff. It is an entirely different tariff than RS-402. And what that provision says—
But that's a conjunctive. So you have to satisfy both.
Correct, but both of those are relating to something other than these de-pancaking credits, Your Honor. What that is saying is RS-402 is not going to supersede or change something we've done with respect to some other tariff situation. It's in effect a grandfathering type of clause for certain types of agreements, Your Honor, which are not at all applicable here. So, and the other thing I would point out about
your position is that this contractual arrangement this particular part of it has nothing to do with the entire purpose that preceded it, was to be certain that those people in the chain of receipt will not have to pay the pancake rates. I'm struggling with why that purpose doesn't frame the entire contract.
Two things, Your Honor. First, just to finish on your prior question, I also wanted to point out that FERC did not rely in its orders on the latter provision that we were discussing. And as you're well aware, the court can't, unlike in an appeal from a district court, the court does not affirm the agency on a basis other than one that the agency relied on. But in response to this question, Your Honor, I would say that if that were the intent of RS 402, is to provide de-pancaking credits for any MISO transmission reservation that OMU has, this RS 402 would have been a lot easier to write and would have looked a lot different than it was, than it has been adopted.
But I think that's not the issue. The issue is, what does it say? And I understand that this was not the clearest of orders. I think that that's a fair statement on your part. But in response to the request for rehearing, I think, didn't FERC make it clear that there was ambiguity here and that it was resolving that ambiguity?
Well, I'm not sure FERC did make it clear, Your Honor. I mean, there is a reference where FERC said something along the lines of, the meaning of this is not certain, but FERC did not tell us what its meaning of this tariff is. And
Mr. Blickensdorfer, I thought they said at paragraph 18 of the rehearing order that it wasn't unambiguous. I agree it's not the best language, but do we have to defer to that finding of ambiguity? And if not, why not?
No, you do not, Judge Thapar. The question of whether it's ambiguous or not is a question of law for this court to decide. And under this court's standard of review from a FERC order of this type, it's de novo. But this court gets to take a fresh look, not only at the language, but also at FERC's, if that's what it is, you also take a fresh look at FERC's finding of ambiguity. I would point out two paragraphs later in the rehearing order, Judge Thapar, that FERC made a statement that suggests its interpretation is something different from what its interpretation was in the initial order. In paragraph 20 of the rehearing order, FERC made the statement that, the exact quote here, Your Honors, that the commission determined that a showing of transmission reservations was sufficient to trigger the reimbursement obligation under RS 402, unquote. Now that suggests that a transmission reservation in and of itself was enough to mandate the pancaking credits. But again, that tariff would have looked very different from this one. And it's also not consistent with FERC having denied OMU's request for de-pancaking credits on two smaller reservations because FERC didn't know how they were used.
Can I ask you two other questions? Before Louisville Gas broke off from the MISO, did cities like Owensboro ever reserve rights, or is this just something that happened after that? Does that make sense? In other words, did they reserve transmission rights before and pay for those?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the record doesn't reflect exactly what was happening before that, but yes, and that is part of, I don't want to speak to, you know, what was in FERC's mind at the time, but yes, that is something that might well have happened before this.
Okay.
Well, is there a difference between might well have and actually did? In other words, did Owensboro ever on its own hook buy power from somebody out on MISO and reserve transmission to get that power. As I understood it, they had a lot of spot purchases, some of which succeeded, some of which didn't, but it wasn't clear whether they did or could have gotten firm power transmission without paying for it individually.
Judge Boggs, you're speaking to the current period for this case? Is that?
Yes, the period before withdrawal, because as Judge Stranch indicated, if we read the contract and the order to say, we want Owensboro to be in no worse position after withdrawal than they were before withdrawal, I'm asking, did they make some of these types of purchases before withdrawal, and under what terms?
Yeah, I would assume so, Judge Boggs, but it's not reflected in this record, I don't think, one way or the other. So,
yeah, but do you understand the reason I asked the question? That is, if back before withdrawal, they could buy power and get it on a firm basis, and now they have to pay $450,000 a month for it, that sounds like they're worse off. On the other hand, if they only could buy spot without paying for it back then it sounds like they're no worse off. That's kind of why I'm asking that question. Maybe your adversary can give me their answer.
Perhaps, Judge Boggs, but I will say that prior to the withdrawal from MISO, I mean, MISO is a regional organization which provides a single transmission rate, de-pancaked rate throughout its territory. So that would have been the situation before this. I would say again, though, that if the goal were to prevent any pancaking of rates whatsoever, this tariff would have been written in a way that said LG&E pays for all MISO transmission charges incurred by OMU, but that's not what it says.
Can I ask one more question?
Oh, go ahead, Judge.
In your request for agency rehearing, I didn't see you mention your corresponding services argument. If you didn't, do we have jurisdiction to consider that argument?
We did not mention it in the rehearing motion, Judge Thapar, and there is a jurisdictional bar for anything that it's not in the rehearing petition. What I would say in response to that, however, is that what was clearly mentioned in the rehearing petition was the distinction between the periods before August 4th, 2018 and after, and that's the argument really that we've made on appeal in the alternative. So that is clearly there. It's the first argument in the rehearing petition.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome, thank you.
Thank you, you'll have your rebuttal time. Ms. Banta?
Good morning, Carol Banta for the commission. I'll begin with the last discussion about what Owensboro would have had prior to the withdrawal in 2006. I don't think it's disputed in this case that when Louisville was a member of the Midwest operator, that customers such as Owensboro could have bought whatever kind of transmission service under a single unpancaked rate from the Midwest operator. And that's precisely what the 2006 orders were about retaining. I don't know.
Can I ask a follow-up to that? Because I'm not sure I follow. So If they had just a simple reservation of rights, right? Do cities ever do that in the MISO itself that is separate and apart from paying for a load of electricity?
Yes. I mean, point-to-point transmission reservations, I don't know if reservation fully describes what it is. It is the right to use that, for lack of a better word, capacity on the transmission system when you need it. And firm means you get it, as opposed to being something that could be curtailed or unavailable to
right. you. So if I pay at $10 a month just to have the right to buy electricity, what you're telling me is that exists both pre-Louisville Gas withdrawing from the MISO and post?
It's quite standard. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so then why is Louisville Gas held responsible for months in which no electricity is transmitted? In other words, the first 3 months, no electricity was transmitted, yet Owensboro paid over $1 million for a reservation of rights. Explain to me how it makes sense that under the language of 402, they could be held responsible for that.
Well, a couple of answers to that. First, I would go back to the way Judge Stranch framed the question, that the question about pancaking pre versus post 2006 frames this entire contract. Prior to 2006, a customer like Owensboro would have bought one single point-to-point transmission reservation, and there wouldn't have been anything pancaked for Louisville to reimburse them for, because they're paying two now. They're paying for the service they're getting from Louisville, and they're paying for this reservation to be able to get power out of MISO. That's a pancake.
I'm trying to separate. Sure. So explain to me how, when you get no electricity, in months you get no electricity, there's pancaking going on. Because it says in the contract, right, for loads, I can read you the specific language. In RS 402, it says for loads that are transmitted or something to that effect.
It says, but it goes to the cost of transmission service incurred to deliver such purchased electricity. And this is where the commission's factual findings come in.
Right. So I'm sorry to interrupt you. I apologize. I look at that as two separate things. So there's when they have to pay and how much they have to pay.
Well, it's what transmission service did they buy to be able to make the purchases that actually happened. And the reason that the commission's factual findings, which again, I'll note are conclusive under Section 313 of the Federal Power Act, or because they are based on substantial evidence. First of all, the reason that need came into play here, Owensboro established, they demonstrated based on substantial evidence that they couldn't count on getting a short-term transmission reservation when they needed it. They put data in the record that out of several hundred requests over a 5-year period, over 60% of them had been denied. So we're talking about when they're looking to buy supplies of energy.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Is this post?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
That was 2013 to 2018 was the data that they put in. So they're looking at a situation, and again, they may not have purchased too much before 2006 because their two units were 15 years younger. This comes up because their own generation is approaching its retirement age. So they were looking at the possibility, which actually did happen, of outages.
Because I agree with you that on your factual findings that we would defer under either clearly erroneous or our traditional deference, which we do in this area. But can you take a step back? Because the same question I asked your friend, paragraph 18, where you all in the rehearing, it's the first time I found that you mention ambiguity, I think. And in paragraph 18 of the rehearing, you say it's not an unambiguous, but do we really give any credence to that when you don't offer an alternative meaning? In other words, the law requires to make an ambiguity finding, you actually demonstrate, and we review your review of the contract de novo, I think you'll concede, under the MISO case that Judge Sutton wrote.
Although I actually would look, even the Sixth Circuit agrees that when the commission relies, number one, on its technical institutional expertise, it gets deference. But also, I'm sorry, could I add that?
Yes, go ahead.
The deference to the commission's interpretation of its own orders, and its own orders are the entire setting. This rate schedule doesn't exist had the commission not directed Louisville to do it.
I agree to get the backdrop of that, but the point is that the language of the contract you found ambiguous. This is purely, the one thing that's in the court's bailiwick is interpreting contracts. Everything else maybe is in yours. But it seems to me the language of the contract, which you found ambiguous, and go ahead and look at paragraph 18 or anywhere you want, and show me where you laid out how there are alternative meanings. You could do it against the backdrop of your orders. You could do it in that way and explain it, such that we would defer to anything. In other words, all you say is it's unambiguous, and just show me in that where it says anything else that they didn't know it's unambiguous.
Well, I think what the commission, I think, acknowledged that Louisville's interpretation that it believed to be the plain meaning was a potential reading that the commission found not workable because it didn't account for other parts of the contract. So it's ambiguous because it could mean what they're saying, except that that doesn't really account for all the terms of the contract, and it doesn't get them what their plain meaning interpretation doesn't get them what they're asking for, because there are in fact purchases, and there's no language in the contract that limits the that requires a certain load factor or requires precise matching of the times of delivery I think I should step back and what I had meant to get to earlier about the need. The reason this is a 5-year reservation, as far as I understand it, that's what they could get a firm transmission reservation from the Midwest operator. So when the commission says that they've shown that they needed this, they didn't overbuy, they didn't buy too much. That goes to the hoarding protections that are in the agreement as well. There are concerns under the definition of merger mitigation de-pancaking. And then again, a couple pages later on Appendix 38, there's a subsection C. The concern in this contract was that a customer would overbuy and try to shift the cost. So, and the commission made a finding in the first order that this did not amount to hoarding for precisely the reason that they found that Owensboro needed to buy this firm transmission reservation to be sure that it could deliver power when it needed it, given its track record of trying to get short-term reservations. So having found that, and having found that it actually was used to make purchases, I think what the commission says, if you look at paragraph 43 in the complaint order on appendix 377, the commission says that Owensboro has demonstrated that it needs this reservation and it has used it. And I think that the commission ties that to or sees in that the language of 1A1 that says it incurs to deliver such purchased electricity. This transmission reservation was the cost that Owensboro incurred to deliver the purchased electricity.
So your point is that a reservation of rights standing alone, which I think we can both agree doesn't actually get you electricity, is actually a purchase of electricity. It gets you electricity when you order it, but it doesn't get you electricity on that date or on any subsequent date.
I think I need to clarify the difference between the transmission purchase and the energy purchase. It's not a reservation of rights. It is the vehicle for delivering whatever Owensboro might buy at any time from a power supplier. So it buys the transmission rights, rights isn't even the word. It buys the commitment that it can get as much as X number of megawatts delivered on demand by the Midwest operator. It then buys the power itself from Big Rivers or someone else.
What if Owensboro bought a 10-year reservation of rights and paid $10 million and never ordered electricity? Would Louisville Gas be responsible for that?
Well, that's where the commission would be looking at the proof of need and the hoarding concerns. That's why it looks at was this something that they
But here weren't only 3 orders over 5 years?
Oh, the evidence in this record is only 1 year, and I don't think it's even a full year. And sometime after this record, I believe they entered into a larger supply contract that is ongoing until 2024. But we're not talking about 5 years with no deliveries. This record stops somewhere in late 2018, I believe. So the commission faced with that case would say, did you overbuy? How is this reasonable? And again, looking back to the original framing of what would they have done before 2006 and what could they have done before 2006? But the limiting principles that the commission had, made a note about that. The need, finding need, and certainly allegations of hoarding, which were specifically.
Well, let me take you. I was just about to ask about the going back to make sure I have right what happened before 2006. At one point, you said, "Oh, all of their units were working fine," but if they hadn't been, in 2005, if they wanted a five-year contract with MISO, would they have had to pay a lot for it the way they pay a lot for it now?
I don't know what the Midwest operators' rates were, but yes, I mean, they would have had to pay whatever that rate was.
Okay, and so if that's the case, then looking at the big picture, and they, Owensboro, would have had to pay for that in 2005, why do they now get to shift that onto LG&E?
Because they're paying more to LG&E, whatever that dollar figure is. They're paying LG&E, and they have to go pay for the pancaked rate. The whole issue in the 2006 orders was if you're leaving...
So before 2005... then they wouldn't have had to pay LG&E anything if they had bought, let's go back to our prototypical purchase. They want to buy power from Wisconsin or somewhere. They want to have a pipeline that's available all the time. They pay MISO a bunch of money, and then they don't pay LG&E anything. Is that your proposition?
No. LG&E was a member of MISO and recovered its costs through the transmission charges throughout MISO. So whatever anybody,
am I not right that they weren't paying LG&E anything extra for getting this power to their customers? Hypothetical purchase power.
They would not have been paying a pancake charge, but that's not to say that LG&E would not be receiving money, as it would be recovering money as a member of MISO.
Okay, but they would only get it out of MISO, not out of a separate charge, and now you're saying there is a separate charge. Okay,
well, because LG&E was MISO. It was in MISO, and its
okay,
facilities
so the
were
question-
operated...
All right, I get it. The question back to your adversary on rebuttal is, well, how about that? Now aren't you getting an extra charge on top of it? So we'll see what they say. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
And Mr. Pomper.
Hey, please the court. David Pomper for Owensboro Municipal Utilities. Like other utilities, like the petitioner, Owensboro strives to provide uninterrupted service. It therefore makes years-long commitments to cover even sporadic outage risks. With its aging local coal plant limping toward retirement, Owensboro needed to make durable arrangements under which it could, whenever necessary, import replacement electricity from MISO.
Can I just ask one question? Did you ever make a reservation of rights before 2006? Did Owensboro ever do so?
Let me explain how things worked while Owensboro and LG&E were in MISO, because I think that is pretty pivotal. And this is explained in our brief at page 3, where we talk about license plate pricing. When LG&E was in MISO, as now, a customer on LG&E's system would pay for network service, which means they pay their load ratio share of their load within the LG&E area. When LG&E was in MISO, that bought an all access pass to all generation in MISO. So if Owensboro needed to import power from elsewhere in MISO, and at the time it had two functioning relatively young power plants, so it probably didn't need to, but had it needed to, it had the right under its network service arrangement with MISO, by paying for its share of the LG&E zone, to buy power from Wisconsin or anyplace else.
But they had the right to buy power, but did they also have the right to get it on an uninterrupted firm basis?
Yes, that is part of network transmission service, and it would have been no additional charge to pay to the Wisconsin transmitter or anybody else in MISO. You just pay for your share of the LG&E zone, and that right comes with it. And what the commission was trying to replicate in its 2005 orders was to ensure that once LG&E pulled out of MISO, customers within LG&E continued to have that right. And that also goes back to the 1998 merger order, the commission relied on the fact that LG&E was going into MISO in 1998 to cure market concentration in delivering short-term energy at whatever turned out to be the year's peak hour. That's at 82 FERC, page 62-220. So it was concerned about uses that were not continuous, but on an emergency basis, and they wanted to ensure that customers continued to have the ability to do that without paying an additional charge, which arose only because of LG&E's unilateral decision to pull out of MISO. We talked about proration earlier. If MISO prorated the charges, there wouldn't be a dispute here. The problem is, in order to get a long-term reservation where nobody else can cut in front of you in line and it's firm delivery, you've got to pay for a long-term rate. Owensboro reserved really the minimum size and duration of transmission rights over MISO that suffice to assure it could reliably import power from MISO when aging plants went out of service. They are now, by the way, both retired. Owensboro's entire requirements power is being supplied by Big Rivers from within MISO. So for most of this five-year period, all of the power to Owensboro is coming from MISO.
So just to clarify that, even though you're saying it's within MISO, isn't Big Rivers just around the corner from Owensboro?
It is, but it's in MISO, and therefore you've got to pay the MISO transmission rate to get power from there to Owensboro. And of course, if a company has a problem with how MISO is charging for that, they have the right to go to the commission and file a complaint. But, until that happens, everybody's got to pay the rate that's on file. It is what it is.
Thank you. Are there further questions? No, you may have your rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Strange. Judge Boggs, I want to bring up a key difference between the pre-2006 era and the current era that hasn't come up yet. And that is, under the current rate schedule 402, the way the credits work for an import of electricity from MISO through LG&E's control area to OMU is that LG&E gives a credit in the amount of the MISO transmission charges. On the whole, those charges are higher than LG&E's transmission charges to OMU. So the end result in many instances, probably almost all instances, although it's complicated, the rate structures, but the end result is that after the MISO credit is applied to LG&E's transmission rate, LG&E actually pays OMU for this transmission reservation. So OMU is getting paid by LG&E to reserve this long-term massive reservation.
What is your answer to what the situation was before 2006? Because I thought your adversary or adversaries are saying that before 2006, OMU could get all the power from MISO at no transmission reservation charge, that all they did was pay the freight for the electrons on the day they used it. Is that correct or not?
Well, the way you phrased it, I'm not sure that's what they were saying, Your Honor, but I think we would all agree that pre-2006, to the extent OMU transmitted power through MISO, which included LG&E at that time, they would pay a single MISO transmission rate, right? After 2006, they pay two transmission rates, MISO and LG&E, but for transactions that qualify under RS-402, the MISO transmission charges are credited against the LG&E charges. Which is the point I was just making is that usually results in a negative because the MISO transmission charge is higher. But the end result is that OMU gets a net credit courtesy of LG&E for taking a MISO transmission reservation. LG&E.
Thank you, Tom. Do you have any further questions, Judge Boggs?
No, that's fine.
I think your time is up. We thank you all for your arguments. It's a complex case, and we appreciate you lending your expertise to us. The case will be taken under advisement and an opinion rendered in due course.